weekend. I'm here to ruin it for you. Hopefully no problems, so I'll get some of that for you. So when I was meeting with the TAs last week, they had one message for me about the workshop. They said that this problem, number five, where I asked you to think about beta decay, was problematic, that people have issues with it in the workshop. So I thought I would just step through this one for you. I chose it in part because it's important and cool as an example, and we're doing modern physics, so it'll touch base with lots of stuff that we'll talk about later in the semester. But the other reason is it is a relatively simple example of what you can do with the power of four vectors. Now, I wasn't in workshops, but my hope is that you guys try using the minimum energy conservation to solve them. And certainly you can do this, the minimum energy conservation, without using four vectors, no problem. But if you use four vectors, then it goes more or less like this. I'm fine if instead of neutron decays into a proton electron. Of course, most of the time beta decay, the neutron is sitting in the nucleus. And part of the reason for that is a free neutron actually isn't stable. It decays with a lifetime of about 20 minutes. So it's better to have them bound up in a nucleus if you're actually trying to do this sort of thing. But you have a nucleus at rest with mass A, and this is the initial state. It's just sitting there. So it has zero free momentum, right? And then in the final state, this nucleus decays into a different nucleus, so one which has an additional proton. The neutron basically goes into a proton in that nucleus. And the electron is ejected. So this is what's called beta decay for a naturally radioactive thing. Well, whether they're naturally radioactive or not, this is what we call beta decay. And so in terms of four vectors, we start, if you use the relativistic minimum energy conservation, we have the four vector equation of the four vector of the initial state is equal to the sum of the four vectors here, which is the final state. Right? And then because I've done this before, I pull trick, which is to pull this one over to the other side and the A over here. And I do that for the following reason. I know that one of the things I want to do is square both sides, because when you square four vectors, you get something you know, which is the mass. So it's a nice way to get some things that you know about. The other reason that I'm doing this is I'm after the energy of the electron, so I want to have that on the other side. And the other thing is, I know that when I square this, I'll get some mix of elements of the two individual four vectors. And this four vector is particularly simple because it's at rest in the initial state. So it's only, you know, energy is the mass, and it has a zero four vector, about three vectors. So I square both sides, right? And remember that when you square four vectors, you get the invariant mass. So this is the invariant mass of nucleus B times C squared, and then you get this minus sign because that's the way it works out when you square four vectors. I square the other side, and now I actually have to expand it out because I have this square of this difference. So that would be, if I just expand this, I get the PE squared term, the PA squared term, and then the cross product, minus 2 PE PA. And these are all still four vectors, okay? I haven't done anything for four vectors. This is the four vector for the electron squared, so I get a minus mass of the electron. Am I dropping a square here? I have to think about that. You get mass squared. Double check notes on that. I forget. I told you I had a column brain, which is why I get a formula sheet, right? So when you square a four vector, I'm forgetting now whether you actually have a square here, but the point is you get the invariant mass, and it doesn't actually matter if this problem is a square or not, unless you're actually trying to calculate it out. At any rate, so the left-hand side is this invariant mass piece. The right-hand side, you get the mass for the electron here, the invariant mass, the mass for nucleus A here, okay? And then you get this dot product of the two 4-vectors, basically, which when you do a 4-vector dot product, or 4-vector times a 4-vector, remember what you get is you get a minus the zero term, the two pieces multiplied by each other. So the two just carries forward, and then the zero term for PEPA is the electron energy and the nuclear energy. And then you add to that the dot product of the 3 vectors, so the 1, 2, and 3 terms, which is the dot product of the 3 vectors of these two, of the electron and the nucleus. The reason that I pulled the A over to the other side is now should become apparent. I know what the energy of the initial nucleus is. It's just a mass. It's just sitting there. So that's the mass. That's Ma. And I know what this dot product is because the nucleus, the initial state, isn't moving. So that's zero. So this falls out. That becomes mass. And now I have to solve the energy of the electron. And what you see when you solve for the energy of the electron is it is equal to a number. Because these masses are fixed. Given the way I have masses, electrons have a mass. So when you calculate this out, you just get a number. Yes?
What is that number?
I don't know. Does it matter? It matters if I want to go look at it.
It matters if I want to know if I did it right.
Right. Okay, but yeah. So check the formula and see if you got it right. But double checking on whether there's a square for that M. If there is, okay, so that means that these should all have, all the M's here should have squares. Boom, boom, boom. All right. Now, So playing with the 4 vectors a little bit is the point of the problem for this class at this point. Now we're going to tell you why I like the problem, and it's not something I give you on a test or anything, but what's cool about this, I mean, there's nothing wrong with this, right, which caveat on the square problem. You get a number. So when you go and you look at the beta decay spectrum for particles coming out of nuclei, you expect to see a fixed energy for the electron. And when you go and you look, what you see is some smeared out thing. And in this case, for this particular nucleus, that's not too legible, bismuth, I think it is, 210. If you were to calculate this number for bismuth, you'd end up with something peak right at this endpoint. And that's not what you see. You see it all smeared out. So this is a problem, because that should be something fairly simple in two-body kinematics is known. So what happened historically was in 1930, this was known, and Wolfgang Pauli suggested that there is an additional particle that's emitted, which is neutral, and you don't see it, so it interacts very lightly with regular matter. So instead of seeing this peak at the energy that we calculated, you get this smear. Okay, you might expect to see this smeared out a tiny bit because any detector you have can't measure it perfectly, so you'll end up with the distribution. So it turns out Enrico Fermi renamed the particle the neutrino because the neutron had been discovered. And it was very massive and clearly wasn't able to account for this. So the name sort of got used. And so it was renamed neutrino. Neutrino also, eno means something little in Italian. So neutrino is a good word for it. And it has to interact very seldom with matter. And I really, really mean seldom. If you were to take a 3-MeV neutrino, which is a fairly common energy neutrino out of nuclear reactions in the sun, it would have an interaction length, which is sort of a distance it would go where 2/3 of them would interact. So if I had a big beam of them, that interaction length, if you used regular water, like in a swimming pool, would be 53 light years. So the only way you can actually ever see neutrinos is you have to have huge detectors and you have to have huge fluxes of neutrinos. and then occasionally you'll see one. Okay. Most of them go right through everything. You have them going through you all the time. And it'd be an interesting calculation to see if any one of them would actually interact with your matter in your body in your lifetime, given the flux of neutrinos that you have coming through. Yes?
What actually causes them to interact when they do interact?
So there are different ways to answer that, but the way that I like to answer it is the way in which they interact. The answer is better given at the end of the semester when we'll really talk about the picture that we have and how they interact. But the way that we have them interact is they exchange a particle, and that particle is so massive that this process can only happen over a very, very short distance. So it's a sort of phase-based issue. It turns out that the strength of the interaction is as strong as the other interactions that we have. But the fact that the particle that they exchange, which makes the force happen, happens over such a short distance that it's like you're throwing a dart and you very seldom get near the bullseye. So they have to approach so closely to some other particle in a point-like fashion that it almost never happens. But when they do go that close, it happens with a reasonable probability. As we get into do some particle physics and nuclear stuff, as we get sort of tied into uncertainty principle and things, we'll talk at length about that.
So they don't happen, it doesn't happen very often, and in fact it took
25 years before anyone actually detected them, and Sky Rhinus and Cowan at Savannah River nuclear reactor in South Carolina, they made a big vat of cadmium chloride dissolved in water. And what would happen is neutrinos produced in nuclear reactions in the nuclear reactor would interact with protons in the material inside the tank. And when they did that, they would actually generate a positron, which would positrons interact with electrons and give you two photons. And they liberate a neutron, and the neutron will bounce around and eventually give you some light. And so what you see are phototubes all around the tank where they can measure. And they look for a coincidence of certain energy things, and they were able to demonstrate that they saw neutrinos. So neutrinos were discovered in 1955. People actually thought they were massless for many years. And then we discovered in the 1990s a quantum mechanical effect of neutrinos, which demonstrated they had mass. But their mass is really, really small. So one of the things, cutting-edge experiments that's happening these days, people have done many experiments, and it turns out that the mass of the neutrino is so small that it's extremely hard to measure. And the reason I'm bringing this up is there is an experiment that is looking at for the mass of the neutrino by basically doing the beta decay and then looking at the very endpoint of that spectrum. Because if you think about what we calculated, if, in fact, this smearing is the fact that you have three particles produced, you have basically the neutron goes to a proton, an electron, and a neutrino, okay? Then if you ask what is the maximum energy that the electron can have in two bodies, then it means that the electron carries away the very most energy when the other two particles are at rest, and the only energy they carry is their mass. So if the neutrino is massless, then if you know the mass of the nucleus, you can calculate that endpoint exactly. And that would be exactly what we just calculated, actually. Because the neutrino basically would not carry, there's a limit where the neutrino would carry no energy. If the neutrino has mass, then it means that the maximal energy that the electron can have basically goes down to, it's this threshold value minus the mass of the neutrino. And so there's an experiment. Many experiments have tried to look for this, but there's a huge one right now going on. So what they're doing, you can see that. Here's the beta decay spectrum that we've just seen. At this very endpoint, what they're doing is they're trying to measure this in gory, gory detail. And if the neutrino has mass, instead of this red line, you would get this blue line, And this would basically be a measure of the neutrino mass.
And it's the mass is really small, so the way they have to do it is when you have beta decay, they have to measure these energy of the electrons really, really, really well. And so they have a spectrometer, which they have in Karlsruhe, maybe saying that incorrectly, in Germany.
Where basically they have tritium, the beta decay happens, the electrons come flying away, and then they spin around in this magnetic field, and you know, curvature depends on the momentum, which has a dependence on the mass. So they can actually, and you can measure the energy very well by looking at how it curves in the magnetic field. So basically that's how they're going to do it. To get the precision they need, the spectrometer has to be huge. And here it is, coming into the lab after fabrication, and yes, these are houses. Right? It's absolutely huge. So this is a big experiment, and this is sort of cutting-edge stuff that's happening these days, where people are trying to figure out the actual rest mass. Okay. Any questions? Thoughts? Okay. So this will tie into lots of stuff we talk about as the semester goes on, but.
At any rate, if that wasn't exciting enough for you, then we can go back to what we were doing
at the in last class. If you recall, we were talking a bit about harmonic oscillations, and we looked at harmonic oscillations rather than just simple harmonic oscillations. We looked at a couple of different forms of it last time. So in one case, you can add a damping term that depends on the velocity of the motion of the harmonic oscillator through the substance. And when you add this term and you solve this, instead of just getting the straight harmonic, you get a straight harmonic multiplied by an exponential. The exponential has the damping term in it, the b. So if b is 0, this piece becomes 1, and you revert back to a straight simple harmonic oscillator. But if you have a non-zero b, then you have viscosity, or basically friction within the liquid, or whatever it is that you're doing. It doesn't have to be a liquid. But the oscillator then will lose energy, and it will, the amplitude, when you basically will fall exponentially with a time constant that depends on the mass of the object oscillating and the b. So, depending on the size of the b and the mass, you can have the thing oscillate back and forth and the amplitude drop off exponentially, or it can basically drop, be damped such that it never actually really fully oscillates. So there are different ways to look at it. And so the frequency that you get is modified by this damping term. And again, if the damping is 0, this goes back to the, for a regular spring, goes back to the K over here.
We also looked at force oscillations, where in addition to the damping term, you add a term which is feeding into the oscillatory system with a harmonic force with amplitude F0. So this harmonic force has a frequency omega, and omega 0 would be the natural frequency of the system, which is what you mean when you don't have the damping in the force term. So that would be sort of the K over M for the spring. And what happens when you solve this is you get a solution for the amplitude, which goes as this F divided by this term. And if you look at this term, it has a damping piece, but then it has this difference in the two omegas. And what that means is when the forcing frequency, omega, approaches omega 0, this term goes to 0, and you'll get an increase in the amplitude, and that's what we call resonance. So depending on the specifics of the system, you can have a resonance which is really quite dramatic or less so. So this is a big deal in most areas of physics. You'll see examples of resonance. So just get used to it. You'll see it in mechanical engineering. That's why buildings don't fall down, it's because you dampen these things. You see it in electricity, you see it in particle physics, etc. So you'll see this kind of thing happen a lot. You okay with that? All right, so we then started waves last time, and waves, just to recall,
are really made up of elements that are undergoing simple harmonic motion. So each element of the waves you can think of as just going up and down. What makes it a wave is they're effectively tied together longitudinally so that when one goes, the other goes, and there's a time dependence on these pieces. Generally speaking, we only worry about harmonic stuff because we can use Fourier analysis to take any shape and create it out of an infinite sum of harmonic series of different frequencies. I may actually end up doing that with this class because I was thinking about it over the weekend. There's some stuff to be gained for this class to do that, so we may actually go through that. But once, for now, let's not worry about it, but when you have a wavelength, you have a period which, if you take any piece of the wave, is the time it takes for it to do its motion one full time. You have this thing periodic in space. If I were to freeze time and we were to walk along it, we would come back to something that looks just the same over a distance of one wavelength. This we define as an amplitude. And then we have a general formulation for a harmonic wave. So the displacement in y as a function of x and time goes as the amplitude times the sine of kx minus omega t plus some initial phase angle, which is what you can determine by setting x and t equal to 0. So when you have a minus sign here, this wave goes to plus x. When you have a plus sign in here, the wave goes toward negative x. And the k and the omega are set up to enforce the spatial and temporal periodicity of the wave. Okay? Looked at the condition of constant phase, so we take that piece that's inside the harmonic and we ask what happens if we set it equal to a constant or zero, and we ask what happens as a function of time, that is, can we determine the speed with which the condition of constant phase moves, which is, if the wave was traveling past you and you locked your eye on a piece of the wave, how fast would it go? And what we found is when we take this derivative that we can derive how fast the wave goes as a function of time as the wave velocity v, okay, which is just lambda over t. We'll use different symbols for wave velocity. Usually v, when we get into light, it's usually c. Sometimes get things all mixed up. So just keep your eyes open on that. Waves generally come in two pieces, one where the oscillation is transverse to the direction of motion, the other where it's along the direction of motion, and transverse waves and longitudinal waves. And then the velocity of the wave will depend really on how easy it is for the pieces in the medium to move. That's a way to think about it. And Gene Coley, actually, they derive for you the velocity of the wave, which I'm not going to bother doing. But the velocity of the wave, transverse wave on a string, goes to the square root of t over mu. Hopefully makes some sense. This is the mass per unit length, so the heavier the piece of the string is, the slower the thing should go. And this is tension, and yes, it is using the same symbol as period, so you do have to know which one you're talking about by context, just for fun. Okay, and then for things like materials where sound is moving, this similar derivation gives you bulk modulus over rho. Bulk modulus basically is a measure of the compressibility of the material. So you can imagine if it's really hard to compress it, it's going to be hard to make things move. So that'll... actually, that intuition is backwards, isn't it? Not to think about the intuition on that. At any rate, this is what it is numerically. So you'll find yourself using those some in various problems, using certain types of waves. So at the end of class last time, I derived for you what is known as the one-dimensional wave equation. And in this case, when I derived it, I used c as the velocity of the wave. So just be aware of that. And you see a second derivative of the wave function, which I'll call psi, as a function of time, and is equal to the second derivative of the wave function with respect to space. And this, we probably will look at three-dimensional versions of this, but for now we'll just do 1D. And anything, any function psi that satisfies this equation is a wave. Okay? So what I'd like to do now is to actually look at energy and power in traveling waves. So imagine that we have a stream with a wave traveling on it. And at any given point, we have some chunk of the string, which I'll say is a length dx. And this piece of string may be moving, and I'll say it's moving with a velocity u. So the piece of string, remember, the string doesn't move with the wave, it goes up and down. So the velocity at any given point is in terms of y. And y is equal to a times the cosine of kx minus omega t. We'll let phi equal 0. So x is going that way. So what I'd like to do is to calculate the energy that this piece of string has at the moment, kinetic energy. So because it's a differential piece of dx, I'm going to call it a differential energy. So we have the differential energy of this piece. I'm going to give it a different symbol. I'm going to call it dk, which is going to be d kinetic energy. Okay, so dk is going to be, it goes as 1/2 mv squared, so it's going to be 1/2 times the differential mass times u squared, right? Because u is the velocity of this piece. U is equal to dy over dt, so that's going to be minus a omega times the cosine of kx minus omega t. And then this thing gets squared, so the differential piece of the kinetic energy goes as 1/2 Let's say that this string has a mass per unit length so our dm goes to mu times dx so this becomes 1/2 times mu dx times u squared, which is this minus a omega squared times the cosine of this argument squared. You with me? Yes?
Is it supposed to be sine?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Physics is weird, but we do actually take derivatives the same way. Everybody else.
I'll try and leave you.
I'm not a string theorist, so I'm telling the truth. We may use weird notation sometimes, but okay, so now I want to divide both sides by dt. So dk over dt is equal to 1/2 mu dx over dt. Go ahead and square this. All right, and so then
if you think about what this is the instantaneous transport of kinetic energy in the wave. Which, of course, isn't particularly useful in general, but the time average of that is useful. So, if we look at the time average of any harmonic function, turns out to be just 1/2. So the average kinetic energy transport as a function of time is 1/4 times mu. This piece, the dx dt, is just the velocity of the wave. So this is mu times v times a squared omega squared. Time averaged it, so it turns into 1/2. Now we've looked at kinetic. Yes.
You're saying the time average is just over some period, right?
Yeah. That's standard trick number 43 to get rid of. And it's actually what's relevant. For power things, generally what you're interested in is the average over some amount of time.
This is the time average of kinetic energy.
So this is the time average of the flow of the kinetic energy. Now, that's just the kinetic energy, which we talked about because we can think about it easily. But, and I'm not going to prove it to you, but if you think of a spring, remember the energy flows between the potential and the kinetic, and it turns out that they basically carry the same amount. So the time average of the potential energy in this system, which when the spring is at a certain point, it has potential energy. Now the time average of potential energy turns out to be just the same. So I'm going to take this dk over dt and turn it into a total energy with respect to time, time average, and just make this a 1/2. And this is the average power in the wave. And if we look at this over the area that the wave passes through, then we call it the intensity. So the average power per meter squared is what we define as the intensity of a wave. And intensity is really important, actually. So for sound, the intensity is what you perceive as the loudness. It has nothing to do with the pitch, it has to do with the loudness, okay? So it's measured, I'm not going to go through it, at least not at this point, but we measured in decibels the sound, and it's on the log scale. In light, it's the brightness. And it is a measure of how much energy per time per meter squared is carried in that wave. Really, really important. One of the reasons that I wanted to do this is because the one thing you really want to remember, because it comes up all the time in terms of your ability to think your way through things, this power in the wave and the intensity of the wave goes as the amplitude squared of the wave. So let's just think about it for a moment. Suppose I have a candle sitting here burning. And light, we'll just say the wave for now, is coming out, but it will go out basically spherically. So the energy that you have at any given moment in this flame is distributed spherically, like so. And the particular energy that you have at any given moment, then as it goes out, is spread over an area that grows as 4 pi r squared. The intensity is the power per meter squared. So this will drop off as 1 over r squared, right? If the intensity drops as a 1 over r squared, then that tells you how the amplitude of the electric field in the wave will go. So, for example, if you wanted to calculate, you'll see on PhD qualifier exams or in maybe online exam, calculate the magnitude of the electric field due to sunlight at some frequency or whatever. So you can take the power of the sun and spread it out over 4 pi r squared, the Earth radius of the Earth's orbit, and that tells you the intensity, the power per meter squared at the surface of the Earth. And intensity goes as the amplitude squared. And that gives you the magnitude of electric field at any given point. Yes?
If we derive these equations for energy from a one-dimensional state, how do we go from intensity, which is as meters squared, to two-dimensional quantity?
You do the three-dimensional version, which I haven't done yet for you. I mean, it's not that different, it's just you end up using. I don't want to get into some of that yet. So it's a little, it's a little hand waving right now, that's true. But your intuition will still work.
Yeah, so power is some absolute property of a wave at its source.
Yeah, when the wave is starting, whatever it is, there'll be an amplitude of whatever it is that's waving. And basically that
falls off for r squared.
If it's going out spherically. I mean, if I'm able to funnel the wave, then I won't see that. Yes?
Can you use Phaedra's speech with me?
Kind of what?
Can you use Phaedra's speech with me?
Yep.
One last question. How come from KDT it goes 1-4 and then for DET went to 1.5?
Okay, so for this step, it's because I time average the sine.
Okay.
And when you time average the harmonic function, you get a half if the harmonic in time. Which, okay. And then, so you get the 1/4, and then when you take the next step, it's because I was looking at the kinetic energy here, and I pull out of thin air the fact that the kinetic and the potential energy for the simple harmonic oscillator are equal, so that the whole system, the harmonic of total energy.
Okay.
Which I'm not bothering to prove. Yes?
So, in your intensity equation, was a new term, which I followed it correctly as linear density?
Yes.
So, when you have something like light, what do you insert for linear density?
In the vacuum, what you end up with is a combination of the permittivity and the permeability of free space in a vacuum. How that gets modified when you go into a material is it becomes the permittivity and the permeability. And so effectively means that there's some inertia in the induction of the electric and magnetic fields as they move through the material because of this modification of E and B. And that's what gives you a lower velocity light in a material like that. So that's what gives you refraction, is what that we'll get into. And we'll do We'll get into that stuff in more detail. You asked, so that's the answer. And you made a statement, I don't know, 122. Anything else? All right.
So that's energy flow and waves, and just remember intuition. You know, think about the area it goes over if it's a three-dimensional problem. Think about the fact that it always goes as amplitude squared. Sometimes that comes into play. Perhaps the single most important characteristic of waves in terms of how they factor in into everything else is known as the principle of superposition. And what it says is that if wave 1 and wave 2 are solutions, these two functions are solutions of the wave equation, then psi 1 plus psi 2 is a solution of the wave equation. Because this is so important, I'll waste your time for a moment. If psi 1 is a solution, then it means this is true. And if psi 2 is a solution, it means that this is true. So I'm going to take these two true equations that we know to be true, and I'm going to add them together. Probably do that faster. No, okay, never mind. It wants to act up. So the two left-hand pieces I add together, and then I'll add together the two right-hand pieces. And if you look at this, because these are derivatives and the derivative of the sum is the sum of the derivatives, this is equal to which then proves the statement that these add together and are they. So the reason that that is so important is because it gives us most of the interesting phenomena that we associate with waves, such as interference. So for interference, the way to think about it is if you have two waves, you can think of them as being independent beasts, but they will add together. So at any given point, whatever the function is, it will just add together with the other waves, or in waves, or whatever. So you get things like, if we imagine having two waves traveling on a string, let's say two wave pulses, one traveling this way and one traveling that way. If we let time go like so, then there will come a point where they overlap, and when they overlap, they'll add together, and then they'll just pass right through each other. Like so. So when they interact, it's just the sum of the two amplitudes. Not just sum of the amplitude, but whatever their function is at that given moment. You can imagine. And in the case where they tend to add together, particularly where they add together maximally, so in this case, the way that I'm drawing it when the peak here and the peak here overlap, and it's something twice as big if they start out at the same amplitude. We call such a case constructive interference. And we can do the opposite case, where we have a wave coming in, say hitting one which has the opposite polarity, if you want. So when they pass through together, so when the peak of this one hits the peak of that one, they effectively cancel each other out as a function of time. But then they just travel on like so. And this would be a case that we call destructive interference. You okay with that? So let us imagine that we have two stones. A distance, a distance d apart, and we're at the edge of the pond, and I just do this into the surface of the water. So I create a harmonic wave, water waves coming out, and as you know, these things will go spherically, right? They'll move out like so. And what I'd like to do is to look at how these waves add together at some distance away from where I am. So, we have one stone hitting water here, and one stone hitting water here. And you can imagine that one sends out waves like so, and another sends out waves like so. And what I'd like to do is to ask, what happens, what would be the wave height if I imagine I measure it at some distance here away? Just for simplicity, we're going to consider this as a fairly large distance compared to the small d opening. So a way to think about that is to imagine what happens at some point here, some point P, at this fictitious line in the water that we're drawing. A wave from the source up above, I'll call it source 1, travels a distance d1. A wave from source 2 travels a distance d2. If these things are in time, that is, the initial condition for both waves is the same, their starting point, the velocity of propagation is the same for each wave. If the two waves If the distance 2 minus distance 1 is equal to an integral number of wavelengths, then the phase of the two waves will be the same when they reach that point P, and you'll have constructive interference. You okay with that? Go away. I want you. Okay. So that's constructive interference. So to analyze that a little bit further, let's call this angle theta. And I don't know if you can picture this, but if I were to draw a line right here, such that this distance is d1. Let me finish drawing this. Imagine if point P were right here. If point P were right here, D1 would be here, D2 would be here, and there'd be a straight line going like so. Imagine if that were a wooden triangle, okay? And I take it and I turn it, hinging it about this point. Here's the wooden triangle, and as I open this angle up with the wooden triangle, moving point P along, I open this angle up simultaneously. That's the mental game that I play to satisfy myself that this angle and that angle are the same. So, I don't know. Play with it some in your own head. At any rate, this is, for smallest angle, this is more or less a right angle. This is your distance d. So this distance here, which is the difference between d1 and d2, is equal to d times sine theta. So you need to convince yourselves of that, because you need to be able to go through this exercise. But I will call this distance delta. This is delta. This is D1. This is D1, and this would be D2. Okay. So D2 is equal to D1 plus delta. And delta is equal to d times the sine of theta, where theta is both this angle and that angle going up to P. So the equation that we get for the maxima would be d sine theta is equal to m times lambda. Now, one of the reasons you want to go through this exercise is that, it's conceivable someone will give you some problem someday that actually is set up just like this, and you do it. But what they're likely to do is to be rather obnoxious. So they'll do something like, they'll put something right here that will take this wave and put it 180 degrees out of phase. Or they'll delay it a little bit, or they'll make this rock and that rock go a little bit out of time. So you have to think your way through every time you look at one of these problems. Okay? But this is the type of thinking that you have to do. If instead of wanting to know where along here I have these two waves added together,
suppose I wanted to ask, where do they add together destructively? So where do they cancel out? And in that case, what I'd like to have is to have that distance be equal to the distance of the two paths. Remember, if the paths are the same, such the waves go through the same number of are in phase when they get to that point, that is, they're both together, then they add together. If they're out of phase, then they're not adding together. So I can get that by making this path length be equal to an integral number of wavelengths different from that one, plus or minus a half. Because by making it a plus or minus a half of an integral wavelength, but out off from that one, then I guarantee that they're exactly out of phase.
So if I want destructive interference, so anything where we're adding waves together, we call it interference, basically. So that's the catchword. So in this case, we have D1 and D2. And we want D2 minus D1 to be equal to M plus a half lambda, where M is 0, 1, 2. Okay? If I were to put a magical little device in front of, say, rock 2 that puts it 180 degrees out of phase, or if I manufactured, if I did this, okay? Then these two equations for maximum and minimum get a flip. Okay? So you've got to think your way through this. Alright, so we have a source that is sending out water waves like that, a source is sending out water waves like that, and we say that we have this sort of interference pattern. And
lest you think I speak with forked tongue, alright, so what I have is a layer of water. I have you really can't see it. This piece is nothing but a straight piece that's just hitting. So it creates basically plane waves of water coming forth. So those would be the plane waves coming from this piece that's just hitting the water with a certain frequency. And then they pass through this opening. And we're going to study something, you may have seen it already in some of your stuff, in optics in particular, the phenomena of diffraction, which basically is caused by elements of the water here and the water here in the slit interfering with each other, and it ends up giving you a circular pattern coming out. And as I narrow this, it should broaden out into more of a circle. Okay? So that's known as diffraction, and we'll hit that in gory detail in time. But what I'd like to do is to use this setup to literally create the situation that we were talking about, which is to have two effective point sources of water waves which are in phase. And that we've got now. So we've got the one here and the one here. And here's where they collide. And if you look at where they collide, you sort of see this pattern. Because different thicknesses of water will give you different shading here. So in this region where you get decent collisions, you have places where they add together and where they sort of cancel each other out. So if you look, or you let your eyes sort of follow, you sort of see these almost striations where these things add together or cancel out a bit. What we'll see when we're doing optics, I could have arranged for the demo here, is we'll do the same thing with light waves, and we'll just have a pattern on the wall over here. And what you see when you have that is you'll have a bunch of bright fringes and dark fringes. So this goes with the name double slit. So this would be a mechanical double slit, and we'll do the light double slit in time. So this is a basic demo of wave interference. You okay? Any questions? Am I boring you? Have you seen all this stuff before? No? Yes? Your eyes are open, so I know some of you are awake. All right, so now we have energy and interference, so the fun is just beginning. Here we go. Let us imagine now that we have two waves that pass a fixed point and they differ slightly in frequency. Let's see what happens. So let's start with the two waves. So let's say that we have psi 1, which is a function of x and t, which is a times sine k1x plus omega 1t. And I have to denote the k and omegas for the two different waves because they now can differ. And we'll have psi 2x and t, which has the same amplitude, sine k2x plus omega t, omega 2t. I'm going to set, because I basically just want to examine the time dependence at a fixed point, I'm going to set the position that we are at as 0. So I'm going to call this A sine omega 1t, and this will be A times sine omega 2t. Okay? Now, because we're at this point x and we have both waves traveling past us, we need to examine what we perceive. We have to add the two waves together and use superposition, because that's actually, in the end, what we would detect. So, we'll say that we have psi of xt is equal to psi 1 of xt plus psi 2 of xt. Look it up and use a trig ID, a trigonometric identity. And the one I want to use is that sine of A plus sine. So now A is a generic, for this, A is just some generic argument. Is equal to 2 times the sine of 1/2 a plus b times the cosine of 1/2 a minus b. To prove that to you, look it up.
some trig idea, okay? We've all had to do them in math classes before. Here, we're not going to have to do them, we just have to use them. So, there it is. And if I rewrite the equation above using this trig idea, yeah. It's A minus B. So when you use this, you get psi of xt is equal to 2 times A times the sine of omega 1 plus omega 2 over 2 times t times the cosine of omega 1 minus omega 2 divided by 2 times t. And let's look at these terms. This piece is the average frequency of the wave. Okay? And this piece, hold on a sec, let me come back to that. This piece is the difference in the frequency. So if the two waves are very different in frequency, then we have a high frequency. If they're very close, then we have a low frequency case here. And the way to think about it is to think of this piece along with this piece as giving you an amplitude that modulates what you hear, which is this. Not hear that way, sorry. So a way to think of it is when these two waves add together, you get something that sounds like, that is like the average of these two things, where the amplitude is modulated in time by the difference in the two frequencies. And remember that amplitude is intensity. Okay? So, I want to do a demo, if you've never seen this before. I'm going to do a demo because I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense, but this will help. I have two tuning forks that are nominally identical. And these boxes do nothing but allow you to hear it. Okay, here's one. Alright, so, I don't know, I don't have perfect pitch or whatever, but they're supposed to be about the same. Alright, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a piece of metal on one of these to change its natural frequency. In other words, I'm going to detune it. So I'm going to adjust the frequency of the sound coming off of one of them relative to the other. And I'm going to play them at the same time. So now the fixed position is where your ear is, and you're going to hear the two sound waves coming at the same time, where they're going to differ in frequency. I can adjust how much they differ in frequency by adjusting where this piece of metal is, because that affects how fast this thing can vibrate. Just a
So you can hear the differences for this one. And also the amplitude drops a little bit because it's having a harder time wiggling it. But you heard the difference in the pitch? Okay. So now I'm going to play them at the same time. Because this is down here, the difference in frequency isn't huge. Which means omega minus omega 1 is smallish, and you have sort of a low frequency variation in this amplitude, or the intensity that you hear. Is that cool? Alright, now I'm going to make the frequency difference a little bit bigger by moving this thing up. It's so cool, I'm going to do it again. You can rent these out for frat parties. Pull them out at 3 a.m. Everybody will be settling into it. Alright. You tune it a little bit more. It says for real. Is that cool? It works for life. Now, anybody in here like a serious musician type? How do you tune instruments? What do you play? Piano. Have you ever tuned a piano one with this?
No.
Okay. They make instruments that can do this. But there is a way, if you have two strings and you want them to play the same frequency, you can listen for the beats. And when you get them really close in frequency, the beat frequency gets really slow. Basically, goes where you can't hear it anymore. So sometimes you can tune instruments that way. Yeah.
So since psi is a function of x, and anyone in this room is expanding in the same place as anyone else, can we hear it at a different time, not a different frequency?
Well, the speed of sound. Yeah, it'd be interesting, actually. We have to have pretty precise instruments because we have to be sensitive to the differences in the speed of sound and everything. But we could try to work it out and correct for it as a function of x. But each position x would have something sort of like that. I don't know. I'd have to think about whether it makes sense. But the time dependence would be the same. Right. The amplitude itself would drop off as 1 over r squared. So, I don't know.
Okay.
Okay? What was I going to say? I had something cool I was going to say about beats. And if it was really cool, maybe I'll remember it and give it to you next time. So I'm going to stop there.